Hey guys, welcome back to the Honest Hour podcast. I am recording this episode today, the exact day after recording the Meg Fora podcast yesterday. So I am on a roll. Let's see how long it lasts. I find that I am struggling to be really consistent in this space. And I've also noticed that I think the Instagram algorithm is punishing me for it. I have a tendency to put a lot of boundaries in place around the app because I don't know if you're like me, but I can get addicted to mindless scrolling. And it's just, let's just say it's not very good for my mental health. So when I am not needing to post or research a guest, I am in the habit of deleting the app from my phone. And then when I need to use it again, I re-upload it. And that has made it very difficult to get any good reach when promoting these podcast chats. And it's frustrating, but I still prioritize my boundaries and my mental health over success on the Instagram algorithm. That was a bit of a side note. Anyways, I'm excited that I'm finding myself being a little bit more consistent this week, and we have had amazing guests. Today's guest approached me in the wake of promoting the Dr. Daphne Lyle podcast about integrative medicine and homeopathy. Today's guest is Rona Marimi. She is a mother to six souls, two born and four unborn. She is an advocate for and teacher of the Fertility Awareness Method, also known as FAM, and she dedicates her time to helping others understand their body's natural rhythm and to work with it, not against it. I did a bit of research on Rona and her work after she approached me, and I follow her on Instagram now. I'll share the details in the podcast notes, so have a look. And she shares some really valuable information. Some might find it a bit controversial. And if you fall into that category, I want to invite you to have an open mind and to always remember that you get to do your own research and you get to decide what's best for you. This is one person's honesty. This is one person's voice. And I personally have gained a lot of insight from what she's sharing as someone who was on birth control very briefly in my late teens for hormonal balancing issues. I found I just function a lot better without it. So without ever being familiar with fertility awareness method, FAM, and natural family planning until I came across Rona's platform, that's actually what I've been doing my whole life. And it's worked well for me. So if you're interested in learning more, listen to this episode and enjoy. If you do enjoy this episode, I encourage you to subscribe to the podcast, to leave a review, and to share it on social media or with your friends who might also enjoy it. Thank you again, guys. Have a great day and enjoy this episode. Hello, and welcome to the Honest Hour podcast. I am Christina Mazurek, your host, and I believe that to be honest is to try to convince someone of your discovered truth of something. Your honesty is your work, your story, your relationships, and your worldview. The Honest Hour podcast is a collective voice of global influences. It is through honest conversations out loud that we can rise together through a more diverse understanding of the world. This is your honesty. Enjoy today's episode. Good morning. Hi, Rona. Welcome to the Honest Hour podcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here and thank you for creating this space.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. I'm so excited to share your story and what you're all about with our audience today. I've already given our guests a bit of an intro on how you work with the Fertility Awareness Method. Can you give us your own introduction? Tell us your story of how you became an educator in this space.
Yes, sure. So my story is actually divided into two. If you'd ask me about that question about almost 6 months ago, I'd say that my story started when I was 16 years old and I had a boyfriend. Well, he wasn't sure. He didn't know he's my boyfriend at that time, but I knew. And I wanted to have sex, and I thought that I'm doing the most responsible thing, and I went to a gynae to ask for the pill. I've been on the pill for 16 years. Just to find out that once I wanted to give birth, I have a blood condition that my blood tends to clot when I'm pregnant, especially when I'm pregnant. And that means that I was not allowed to be on hormones at all. Not, and I've been on for 16 years on the pill.
Wow.
I had four miscarriages due to that blood condition until we've realized that that's the issue.
Oh my goodness.
So the first time I got pregnant, like right after I stopped the pill, 2 weeks later I got pregnant at the first ovulation I had, but I had a miscarriage, and that's how everything started. And then after my second child was born, I said, okay, now we can't have any hormones. Let's try the copper IUD. The copper IUD caused me really bad reaction. My hair, I really lost my hair. And I went to my naturopath, and she ran basically every test she knows of, including heavy metals and everything. And everything came out fine. But then she looked at one of my blood results and she says, but there is some inflammation in your body, which I don't understand where it's coming from. And she asked me about what is the form of my birth control. And I said, it's the copper IOD. She says, huh. And then everything clicked. A week later, I was without the copper IOD and I have my hair on my head. And it kind of stopped about 2 months later. It was amazing to see how everything shifted.
Wow.
Now, but this is part of the story. So I told my husband then, okay, listen, we have a problem here. I can't have hormones. I can't have the copper IUD. What are we going to do? And I started Googling, and this is how I found about fertility awareness. I bought the book, which is like the Bible of the fertility awareness. It's called Taking Charge of Your Fertility by Toni Weschler. And it was amazing for me, the information. I'm like, I'm 38 years old and never knew any of those things. Like, how can that even be? But I found it very difficult to chart and to actually start tracking my cycles, especially since I still was breastfeeding. I decided to take a course with an educator. And the first time that I managed to confirm ovulation by myself was like a wow moment for me. Like, wow, that's amazing, that because we are not taught that we can actually do those kind of things. Like, who thought that I can track my fertility? Because since a very young age, all we hear is, once you want to be sexually active or you want to take care of your fertility, you just need to go to the gynae. Only doctors can do that.
Yeah.
And how amazing that it's actually in your hands, and how upsetting and how much anger it also brought to me for all those years. I don't know if I would have done anything different, but at least to give me the option, you know? And 6 months ago, tomorrow, 6 months ago, my mom died.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. Yeah. And I spend a lot of time with my family. And I've learned that my grandmother, from my mom's lineage, had 36 miscarriages.
Wow.
Yeah. And my mom had over 10 miscarriages, and I had 4.
Yeah.
So in the bigger picture, I think this is part of my path to be fertility awareness educator. So long story shorter, I went to study to become a fertility awareness in a program in the States for 2 years, which was really amazing. I came out with the certification, but I felt that I need more information. And since then, I've qualified in 2 or 3 other methods of fertility awareness, because there are many methods of fertility awareness. There's no one method. And yeah, and now I'm also learning about women's health and the hormones and all of that in an international program as well. So this is me.
Amazing. Amazing. Yes, I've seen on your Instagram page that you share a wealth of knowledge, not just on fertility awareness, but on our hormones and our health and how everything is connected. And I have personally found it fascinating. I want to get really granular here for the people that are listening today. You mentioned that you realized quite late, actually, that it wasn't healthy for you to be on hormonal birth control or even on the non-hormonal one, the copper. What is it? The copper ring.
Copper IUD.
The copper IUD. Can you give us, sort of in a nutshell, why is, and I might be using the wrong terminology here, why is birth control, hormonal birth control or not, not healthy for us? And then the second part of the question is, what is fertility awareness method?
Okay. I actually will probably start with what is fertility awareness method and go from there. So fertility awareness method is basically using the understanding of how our body biology works and how our hormones and the physiology of the hormones works in our body, and how our fertility is and how that influences our fertility. In our menstrual cycle, we have 4 different phases, and in each phase we have different hormonal profile, and different hormones cause different things in our body and in relationship with our fertility. Essentially, when we have estrogen rising, it's when we are fertile and we have signs that our body gives us that we are fertile. The signs of that would be we start to see cervical mucus. We start to see that our cervix starts to move. It goes from low, higher, and becomes more soft and more open. And once ovulation happened, under the influence of progesterone, our body becomes a little bit, our basal body temperature, like the core temperature of our body, becomes a little bit hotter. We have a temperature shift, which stays for the rest of our cycle until we get our next period. And progesterone inhibits another ovulation, dries that cervical mucus, and creates our core body is a little bit hotter. So that's a sign for us that ovulation have happened. So we are tracking 3 fertility signs in fertility awareness method, the one that I'm teaching, which is also called symptothermal double check. And sympto is the symptoms, thermal, the basal body temperature, and double check because we are checking with 2 signs when we start to become fertile and when we are not fertile anymore. So we have 2 different checks for that. And that's basically it. We are tracking every day those 3 fertility signs, cervical mucus, basal body temperature, and the cervix position. And gathering that information, we know exactly when we are fertile and when we are not fertile during the course of the cycle. So that's what fertility awareness method is tracking our fertility body signs or biomarker and knowing exactly every single day whether you are fertile or infertile today. And then according to which method you're using, you have a set of rules telling you how to use that knowledge in order to achieve your goals, whatever they might be. You can decide that you want to avoid pregnancy naturally, or you can achieve pregnancy naturally, or simply just to know, because it gives you so much more information about your body. But I'm sure we'll touch about that a little bit later.
Yes.
So that's fertility awareness method. And regarding the first part of your question about the birth control, I'm not here to say why they are bad for you, but I want to explain that our menstrual cycle and our hormones, estrogen and progesterone, are extremely beneficial for our health. Estrogen, for example, helps with brain function, helps to strengthen the urinary tract, pelvic muscles, libido, vaginal lubrication, helps with our maintain our heart health, with our blood vessels, with our breast, helps with skin and hair. It's a hormone that contributes or promotes growth. It's an amazing hormone. We make a little bit of estrogen from our fat tissues and a little bit from other organs, but the most or the essential or the powerful estrogen comes from our ovaries when we are in a natural menstrual cycle. Progesterone is an amazing, a superhero hormone. It supports breast health, heart health, influences the nerve system. Sometimes when somebody got injured in their brain, they gave one of the treatments would be with progesterone. It's amazing for maintaining a bone health. It's really great for mood regulation. It keeps us calm. We utilize food better under the influence of progesterone. It's a keep calm, carry on hormone, kind of. Mm. It has a direct access to the brain and nerves, which is amazing, and protect the nerves from damage, for the brain from damages. It promotes healthy sleep and memory. If we think of all the symptoms or things that happen after menopause, like osteoporosis and a little bit loss of memory and things like that, that's due to the loss of estrogen and progesterone. So that's another way to look at that. So when we are on hormones, and there's only one way for us to make progesterone, and that's via going through natural cycles. So if we are not ovulating, we are not enjoying from the benefits of those hormones of estrogen and progesterone. And that, for me, would be a big thing. Because when we are on the pill, we are not ovulating. When we are on the hormonal IUD, most of the women won't ovulate. And the same with other hormonal contraceptions. So that's a big deal when we are talking about women's health, not to ovulate, because that's the only way we make those hormones. And with a copper IUD, for example, like everything in our, like everything that goes into our body, let's say you have a thorn in your finger. So your body will start to react because it's a foreign object which is not supposed to be in your finger, right? Yes. So you know how your finger becomes inflamed and hot and your body starts to reject. The same way with everything that we insert in our uterus, for that matter, or in our arm, because there is like an implant that we put in our arm that releases hormones, synthetic hormones, as a birth control. So our body will try to reject everything that is not natural to it. And the copper IUD or the Mirena IUD or any IUD for that matter that we insert in our uterus, our body recognizes it as a foreign object as it is and will try to fight it, because that's what our body do.
And that's what our body does. Is it creating inflammation then? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
That makes so much sense. I experienced that when I was younger. I got my belly button pierced because it was the popular thing to do. And I had to take it out very shortly after because it felt like, I mean, it wasn't just that there was infection on the wound, which is quite common, and then you treat it and it goes away, but it felt like there was this foreign object in my body and there was like an internal thing going on. And even when I wear earrings, I can feel my body is fighting a foreign object. And so I just don't do piercings. Yeah. It doesn't work for me.
Yeah, I get that, although I'm very pierced, but you know, it takes, it takes a long time for them my body to adjust to them.
And
so I know all the drill, but somehow I really enjoy having piercings.
No, they are beautiful. I think I'm very sensitive. I've never had a copper IUD or the Mirena or anything like that. Mm. But I imagine that if I did, I would have that feeling like, get it out.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, and with the copper IUD, also copper is something that is toxic to sperm. Now, and that's how it actually works. That's the mechanism of the copper IUD and how it actually supposed to work. And what for me rings a bell is if it's toxic to sperm, which is a human cell, and it sits in our womb all the time, it must do something there. It can't be just, okay, I'm here, I'm just waiting for sperm to come, you know? Yeah. And there are some studies showing that it might elevate your estrogen. So you might be estrogen dominant or have a little bit too much estrogen because of the copper, because how copper works in our body. And it also kind of lowers our magnesium and zinc, which are extremely essential minerals for our body functions. So that's also when we have too much copper, it also compete with them. So it's also something that we need to be mindful about. And for
I have a side note question again.
I
recently had a family member diagnosed with breast cancer, which she was told was an estrogen consuming cancer. I'm not very familiar with all of this. But something triggered the memory of this when you said that copper increases estrogen in the body. Are there any scientific studies or data that proves there's links between the copper IUD and cancer?
No, I don't think so. And I also don't think that there is somebody who would be interested to make those studies.
Of course not.
Yeah. But there are many studies about estrogen dominance and their link to breast cancer.
Yes.
There's a lot. So estrogen dominance is a condition that is not medical. It's not a medical term. They will say excess estrogen rather. But estrogen, as I said, is a hormone that promotes growth. But when it's not controlled by progesterone, because that's what progesterone does, it controls the effect of estrogen. And if we have too much estrogen, then we, as a side, like it's like a seesaw. So too much estrogen will make too little progesterone because they're always in relationship.
And balance.
Yes. So if we have too much estrogen or too low progesterone, that's another option. Then all the people who are very sensitive to estrogen might have all kind of things like fibroids, and that also can contribute to endometriosis, and essentially it can also bring cancer. So that's a very a condition that we do want to take care of. It's not something that we want for our well-being, but also for our health, because it's not for our well-being. We don't feel good when we have too much estrogen. We feel amazing when we have the right amount of estrogen, but too much estrogen, that might be a problem. And interestingly enough, you can, once you start charting your cycles with fertility awareness, you can see symptoms of estrogen dominance. And that's really, yes.
I wanted to ask a question just to clarify. You mentioned that it's super important for us to have the right levels of estrogen and progesterone at the right time in a natural cycle. When you are taking synthetic birth controls, like you're taking these hormonal pills or the copper IUD or whatever it may be, are you not having the natural rise and fall of estrogen and progesterone in your body and you're not getting those health benefits? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying yes. So with the hormonal birth control, you're not having natural cycles. Like our cycle, our menstrual cycle is a communication between our brain and the ovaries. And the hormones, the synthetic hormones, basically what they do, they just cut or disrupt this connection. So on the pill, you are not having natural cycles, you are not having cycles, you are not having periods as well. What you're experiencing at the end of the package is a withdrawal bleeding, and which is completely different from periods. It's not a period. It's a withdrawal bleeding because they are like sugary or placebo pills with that don't contain any synthetic hormones. And from the withdrawal of those hormones, whatever is made in the uterine lining will shed, but that's not a period.
Right. And do we have any information on what the long-term effects are on our bodies when we've used hormonal birth controls for 30 plus years? I mean, I know it's quite recent, so is the data even there? But it sounds like it would be quite alarming.
Okay, so just to finish something, with a copper IUD, you do experience cycles because it doesn't disrupt this natural communication, but it does triggers other things, as I mentioned earlier, with a with the copper and the estrogen. Studies about the pill, there are links to, or there are studies that link the pill with depression, especially in teenage ages. But the effects after, so most of them show that within 3 to 18 months, you should return to your fertility, and that would cause nothing. But while on the pill and while you are on the copper, on the hormonal IUD, for example, there are many, 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 many side effects. And for some women, they are, even when they say, I don't feel any side effect, they still will be without them even knowing. Like with the pill, there is a disruption to the there is a disruption to their gut health because it's being digested. It might disrupt something in their liver, etc., etc. But there are no studies showing there are any other effects, long-term effects after you stop using them. So that's actually reassuring.
Have there been studies, though? Have they actually done trials on women to see what the long-term effects are?
Not that I'm aware of.
That would be interesting to me. Yeah. I feel like it's sort of all an experiment, like a lot of pharmaceuticals, but I guess we will know in time.
You know what? I can actually answer to that a little bit in a different way, if I may.
Sure.
Because we do know what we do know, that the pill or synthetic hormones, because they alter our attraction, they change our attraction to the male, to different males. Like we will be attracted to different type of males when we are on the pill than when we are not on the pill.
So you could, what if you marry someone that you met when you were
exactly.
on the pill?
And then
you,
exactly.
Does
exactly.
this really happen? Oh
it,
my gosh.
It happens. Yes, it happens. That once we'll you are not on the pill, yeah, I have a friend who once she stopped the pill, she didn't find her partner attractive anymore after 3 kids. Like she was on the pill for so long, just stopped for having kids and then continued. But once she stopped, she didn't find him anymore attractive. But it, studies
That's
show
crazy.
That. Yeah. And what else studies show that when you are on the pill, you are attracted to people that you will be attracted when you are on the second part of your cycle during the progesterone part, which is after ovulation. Before ovulation, you are more attractive to who is more suitable genetically to you.
Interesting.
So if we're looking at long term, what does it mean in the long term that our offsprings that we have while we chose our mates on the pill, they're not the most suitable genetically to what we need.
Mm.
So what does it mean in the next generation of the of those offsprings now? Sorry.
It sounds like
can
there
you see where I'm going?
Genetic mishaps. Yeah, I'm putting links together in my head, being my own little pseudoscientist here. Like our parents' generation didn't have as high of a divorce rate as us, but they weren't using hormonal birth control pills until much later. Mm-hmm. And our generation has been almost like raised on them since we were getting our menstrual cycles.
Yeah.
And our divorce rate is much higher. So I'm just wondering, is there a link? And then we're also seeing with the children that are being raised today that they are ovulating sooner, they are menstruating sooner. I mean, we also
more
know
allergies.
The hormonal. Yeah, more allergies. We also know that there's environmental impacts on our hormones and there's so many different variables here. But it's very interesting to look at this holistically.
Yes.
I'd be very interested to sink into the data and make some hypotheses of my own.
Yeah, well, I have my own, obviously, but I think that that can raise all kind of questions about the strengths or the, you know, about the strengths of our offsprings and the next generations.
Well, I'm really grateful that after that one little round of hormonal birth controls in my late teens, I stopped because I just hated it. It made me feel depressed. It made me gain weight. I was like, no, I'm not doing this. And luckily I didn't have any unwanted pregnancies and I didn't really know what I was doing either. But I did choose my lifelong partner when I was not on birth control and I've still never been on it. So I feel a bit more comfortable now.
I actually chose mine when I wasn't. Then I took again for a few months and then I wasn't again. So I'm like, okay, no, I think I'm good.
Okay. We're all, if you're on birth control and you met your partner, maybe just stay on it.
Or stop for a second before you make kids and see if you still.
Man, stop before you're ahead. Goodness, that is so crazy. I mean,
it's
when it comes to any medication, like we're all realizing now that there's a lot that's being promoted at us without the research being honest. We've seen this with the doctors and the pharmaceutical companies, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I do think as consumers, we are being pushed to become more educated and aware on our own. And for me, it's important to think very, very thoroughly before I take any foreign type of substance or medication for my body, because I know that we are a very unique and tender, balanced ecosystem that can be easily disrupted.
But we also need to be mindful that until 1992 or something like that, women were excluded, women in their reproductive years were excluded from research, from all the studies and research because of their hormones. I don't know if you knew that. But
my eyes are popping out of my head right now.
Yeah.
I've never heard that.
Yes, you need to go on my Instagram. I did a post about that a few months ago. Yeah, until the FDA actually said, no, we have to, because they are getting those medications. So we need to see that they are safe for them as well, you know?
That's crazy.
Yeah. And still, there was a scientist that commented on that. She said, until today, when we are doing like on flies, we choose the male flies because they don't have the female hormones of flies. but she said that it's until today, they would rather have males or postmenopausal women rather than women in their reproductive years. And also with the COVID, I'm not going into conspiracy here, but even with the COVID vaccine, then in the questions to understand if there are any side effects from the vaccine, there was no question about the menstrual cycle until women actually raised their concerns. And then they insert those questions because they didn't even think about that.
Mm.
And again, I'm not going into conspiracy theories or anything like that. It's just how it was. That's the fact.
Yeah, it's just being more thorough in the research. And I can understand why if you're doing a scientific study, you would want sort of case people. What do they call them? The
case study?
People in the – yeah, not case studies, but like participants to have as little variables as possible, because otherwise it's going to throw your study and it doesn't give you clear data. So
and it will be more expensive, and it will take longer, etc., etc.
Oh my goodness! So, let me ask you this: how do we track our fertility? Do we use an app? Do we write it down?
So there are two ways. One is by charting it with a paper. There is like a table or chart that everyone can get, even for me. And you can use it with an app, but you need to know what you're doing. So the first thing that a day in a charter life. In the morning, I take my basal body temperature with a specific.
Do you just use a thermometer?
A specific
thermometer. Oh, a specific one. Okay.
Yes. And the difference between a normal one and the one that we are using, it has two digits after the dot. So it's more accurate.
Okay.
And we need to take it the first thing in the morning, and usually the same time, like plus minus half an hour here and there, but around the same time. And then every time I go to the toilet, I check my cervical fluid. It takes about 30 seconds or less. Mm. Once a day after the shower, I check my cervix. And at the end of the day, I bring all the information together. I use an app because I found it really, really, really easy. I use the Radio Body app, and that's like the best app ever.
What's it called? Radio Body. Oh, Read Your Body.
Read Your Body. Yeah.
Okay. And amazing.
It's an amazing app, really. And you just insert everything. You insert the basal body temperature. Like you put the 36.62, for example, and you put the cervical fluid you had that day. Usually you use the most fertile cervical fluid you had that day. You write with like up to 35 characters, basically, what did you see? You click on the cervix and you know whether you are fertile or not according to the information and where you are in your cycle. That's it. So you can use it. You can use either a paper chart or the app. The app basically is like a fancy paper chart. You need to know what you're doing in order to use it.
Will the app tell you based on your data when you are fertile?
No, it doesn't tell you anything.
Okay, so you have to know what to
look
for.
You have to know. Yes.
So what are the... Okay, cool. So what are the key things that we need to look for? If we start temping and tracking, what are we looking for to know that we're fertile? And if we're not trying to get pregnant, these are the signs of don't have sex now.
Yeah. Okay. So usually we say that the first day of our cycle is cycle day one, and it's the beginning of our cycle.
You get your period that day.
That's the period when you get the period. And when I say the period, I mean that when you are actively bleeding, it's not like spotting. Spotting still belongs to the cycle. It belongs to the cycle you are at right now. In order to start a new cycle, it's the active bleeding. Okay. So the day that you actually need to catch that flow, you know, that you put a menstrual
tampon
cup
or a cup,
pad,
yeah.
Whatever. Yeah.
Okay.
So that would be your period. After the period, for some women, not all the women, will have a few days that we are not fertile there. The temperature is relatively low. We see no cervical fluid. And once we start to see a change in that, meaning that suddenly you see something different, either on your underwear, when you're wiping, or when you are inserted like two fingers gently just to see if there's anything there. Once there's any change from before, this is when you need, if you want to avoid pregnancy, you need to avoid unprotected sex.
When you start to actually have cervical mucus after your period is over, then you're entering the fertile period.
That's the point of change. This means something has changed. It means
basically, release an egg.
Soon you're going to release an egg. Usually between 6 to 9 days, that's that period that we are fertile. And ovulation, it usually will be somewhere along the end of this fertile phase. It's not at the beginning. So it tells us in real time that now we are fertile. And why is that? Because the cervical fluid is amazing. Like, I can talk 2 hours on cervical fluid. But I'm that nerd.
No, I also find it fascinating. I mean, I'm pregnant now, so we were trying to conceive, obviously, recently, and I had to become really familiar with cervical mucus.
Yeah. No, it's
sorry,
it's an amazing
process. It's like so TMI to say that. But hopefully it's only women listening now.
Christine, there is not too much information for a woman that deals with cervical mucus. I get pictures and videos of cervical mucus on a daily basis.
Oh, my God. Oh my gosh, we have to normalize it. I mean, hello, we have to empower ourselves. We don't want to take these hormones. We need
yes,
to understand
it's
what's
not
going
gross.
On.
It's amazing. It means that your body is healthy. It's fertile. Like, think of a fertile soil. You won't say that it's gross, right?
No, I mean, our compost pile is pretty nasty. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah,
but my gardener loves it.
Yeah, the same. We also have compost and lots of flies. And okay, anyway.
Yeah, but I know it's all the good stuff.
Yeah.
When I was doing my research, though, they talk about egg whites. And if anyone's listening now and they've tracked and they fell pregnant through like observing all of these things, when you see egg whites, it's go, go, go if you want to get pregnant. So that's your egg white cervical mucus. Even before, because the sperms can last long in there. Hey.
Yeah. Yes. So it keeps sperm alive for up to 7 days. And it neutralizes our cervix, our vagina, because our vagina most of the time is acidic. It has the same pH as red wine. Ooh. And only when we are fertile, when we have cervical mucus, it neutralizes to allow sperm to live in it. It actually feeds all the good stuff to the sperm, and it brings the sperm to meet the egg once the egg is about to be released. That amazing it is.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you start getting cervical mucus, and then you know that you're entering the fertile window. At this point, your cervix is becoming amicable to a sperm's survival. So the sperms can go in, they can live for 5 to 7 days up there. And then once the egg is released, we know that it's being released when we see that egg white cervical mucus.
Been released when you have a temperature shift.
Okay, so we're temping still. Yes. And our temperature
goes
up.
Yes, so the cervical mucus, that egg white and all of that means that you are approaching ovulation. It doesn't necessarily mean that you are ovulating on that day. You are very close to ovulation. Or you might ovulate on that day, but we don't know exactly. We can't pinpoint exactly the day of ovulation. It's really difficult without an ultrasound. And even on ultrasound, they can't tell you that you're ovulating 2 minutes or something. You know, they know that you are approaching according to the size of the follicle, or you have ovulated according to the corpus luteum that you have on your ovary. But they can't tell you that in 2 minutes or 2 hours or tomorrow you're going to ovulate. We can't actually pinpoint. We know that we're approaching, and we know that we have had ovulation according to the temperature shift. But once you start seeing your cervical mucus starts to progress from like white, lotion-like to being more wet, and you start to feel more juicy in your vulva, and when I say vulva, everything that we see from the outside, and you start to feel that wetness in your vulva and start to see the clear, lubricative egg white, raw egg white, that you know that you are approaching ovulation. And if you have a temperature shift. There are women, for example, with PCOS that might have those waves and not ovulate. And what won't have that temperature shift to reassure them or to confirm that ovulation have happened.
When we are done talking about the cycle and what our cervical mucus and our cervix does, I do want to have a side chat on this recording and talk a little bit more about polycystic ovarian syndrome because I don't understand enough about it. And maybe people listening today also don't.
Okay.
So getting back on track, I'm understanding now. Okay. So your temperature is going to go up on the day. But we can't pinpoint exactly the moment of ovulation. But the egg can live for how long?
Up to 24 hours only.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. So
and
always,
the sperm can live up for 5 to 7 days, though.
Yes. So always it's better to have sperm there waiting for the egg rather than the other way, you know, the egg waiting for the sperm. Because if you have ovulated, it's up to 24 hours. It doesn't mean that the egg will live for 24 hours. Usually the average time is about 17 hours. So let's say you've ovulated today at 6 o'clock in the evening. It might be by tomorrow 10 o'clock or in the morning or like 12 p.m. done. So it always better.
Yeah. And how long does it take for the sperms to swim up?
It takes a minute up until it's about up to half an hour. I've seen studies that it can even take a little bit less or a little bit longer.
Wow.
But something like that.
And don't they have, they put like when a man ejaculates in the vagina, is that the right terminology? It's like millions of sperms.
So yes, in one ejaculation, well, in 1 mL of ejaculation, there are about 100 million sperms. And every ejaculation, it's about 2 to 5 mL. So do the math. It's between 200 million to 500 million.
And we have one lonely little egg.
Yes. They have a nation. More than a nation, a few nations there. Listen to that, Christine.
Hang crazy. On.
I'm going to blow your mind right now. Men makes 1,500 sperm per second.
Yes, see. It's unfair. I mean, they can literally have thousands of kids if they had multiple partners. Impregnate multiple people a day.
And we will ovulate throughout our reproductive years, and I'm excluding pregnancies, I'm excluding breastfeeding, you know, 456 eggs in total. That's it, done.
Wow. And when our reproductive years are over, a man of the same age is still fertile.
We continue. Yeah. And still we feel that we need to control our body.
So nature is so patriarchal.
I don't know about nature. We are very patriarchal. In one of my posts, I actually wrote the other day that you know how we value always the things that are more rare in nature, like black pearl, things that like they will, or diamond, that will cost a lot of money, we'll value, we'll keep it like in a safe, whereas things that are more common, it's like, that's fine. But that's not how we treat the egg and the sperm, right?
True. Well, you also did another post that I found quite interesting because I find myself, compared to some of my peers, to be quite educated on the matter of fertility and conception because, I don't know, it was always really interesting to me when we were trying and I've never been on birth control, so I've had to become quite aware. But you did a post that said, and I will read it verbatim now, "For so many years, they thought that the egg, once ovulation has taken place, just sits in the egg tube waiting. But this is not the case," which I didn't know. "It is very active and it chooses which sperm it wants to fertilize with, and it slows down those sperms that it doesn't want to fertilize with." Never knew this. "Although this knowledge was known for quite some time now, it is interesting that no one mentions it." I do find that very interesting. "It is so convenient for our society to stick to the narrative that the egg is passively waiting and the sperm is active and running towards the goal. I wonder if on any deep level it serves the story of patriarchy." And before I read that last sentence and I was reading your post, I thought the same exact thing. Like, I have done so much research on how this whole process works that I always thought that the egg sits and waits and the sperm that gets there first wins. That it was just a race of the sperms.
Yeah, that's what we've been told all those years, but apparently it's really not that like that.
That's crazy. So our
That's
eggs are really
crazy.
clever. We have a lot, even though we don't have as many sperms as we have, we don't have as many sperms that men do as we do eggs, and we are less fertile. Our eggs are super smart and powerful.
Super smart. Our body is super smart and powerful. Our whole body is much more active than we actually think. Like if we, I already mentioned that our vagina is acidic and only when we are fertile is neutral to support sperm survival. The cervix plays a huge role when we are not fertile. It's closed and it's slow, and only when we are fertile it moves higher and opens to allow even sperm to get in. And after ovulation, it closes again and it's done. Also, we create like that mucus plug, that cervical mucus, you know, that before you give birth, you pass out that mucus plug, which is
You only
actually.
pretty form that, right, when you conceived.
No, you form that every cycle. Right
Oh,
after
wow.
ovulation, you start to make it.
Oh,
And if you
wow.
get pregnant, it becomes that mucus plug. And if we are not pregnant, it will re be released ju just before our period comes to allow the period to come out. This is the
Okay.
cervical, that's it. This, the mucus plug is the cervical mucus.
Okay. And let's say, okay, so after ovulation, what happens to our temperature, our cervix, and our cervical mucus if we did not conceive compared to if we did? Is there a difference? Can people start to examine stuff in that 2 week wait?
Not yet, because that's
Okay.
so our temperature is high and it stays high for about 11 to 16 days. And that's that part after ovulation is constant for every woman. Between 11 to 16 days, meaning for me, my that part is always 13 days. It might be 12 every now and then, but it's between 12 to 13 days. It's not one
And that's
time
our
every 12.
luteal, the luteal
That's the
phase.
luteal phase. Yeah, it's
Okay.
constant. What varies, it's up from the period until ovulation. So in that period of
Okay.
time, our temperature is high, the cervix is closed and low, and the cervical mucus might be, you might have nothing, or you might see even something a little bit more yellowish because of the progesterone. Now, once a conception happen. Conception means when when the sperm managed to penetrate the egg,
Yeah.
it's the fertilized egg starts its journey in the tube for about 6 to 10 days until it reaches the uterus. So in those 6 to 10 days, there's no way for you to know. And it depends on your belief system. Our body doesn't even know that we are pregnant. Once it reaches the uterus, it sends like a small root into the endometrium lining, and that is implantation. So only
And
around
then
6 to 10 days. Yes, if it was successful, then it will send a message, a HCG, to the brain saying, "Hey, I'm here." So the first sign for you to know if you are pregnant, if your temperature remains higher longer than your luteal phase. For example, if your luteal phase is 11 days and now you are 16 days and you still have high temperatures, then it might say that, yeah, you might be pregnant. If your luteal phase is 16 days and now you have 18 high temperatures, you are pregnant.
So my luteal phase is always 13 to 14 days. But when we were trying to conceive and I did all my homework on this, I knew that implantation could happen as early as 6 days post-ovulation. So because I loved pee on a stick, I started to test from day six. And I kid you not, I got a positive pregnancy test, a very, very faint one, on day seven of my cycle.
Amazing.
I was even then more psycho. I went to go get a blood test for a quantitative HCG, and I had a level of four. So my best friend who I tell everything to, she was like, Well, I think you are like the person who had the earliest positive pregnancy test in the history because you're so crazy. Because yeah. You shouldn't even get a positive pregnancy test with an HCG level of 4. But I literally, I could only see that second tiny little line, like when it completely dried out, which you're not even supposed to look at it anymore. But I knew.
Yeah.
And then I took the test every day after that and I got my big fat positive. I got the big fat positive on like day 10.
So I had a student like that. I had a student that she couldn't, like, I can't wait anymore. And her
too hard.
Phase was 15 days. So it's like really hard.
Oh,
and
gosh.
She did like 9 days after she had the temperature shift and it was so positive. Like, it was like, yeah. So yeah, but we need to give it at least 6 to 10 days until it comes. Otherwise it can't even reach the uterus. And that's why progesterone is so important, because progesterone makes that endometrium lining. So it's important to have that 11 to 16 days of luteal phase. That's a healthy one. Otherwise, if it's too short, even if the fertilized egg will reach the womb, the endometrium won't be there if it's shorter than 11 to 16 days, because you know the journey is 6 to 10 days. Let's say it's 8 days. So you know, if it's just 8 days, it won't have anywhere to brew in.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And like with my first son, I remember, like, I didn't know much about conception, but I was like trying to test a few days before my missed period, and it was nothing. Negative, negative, negative. I went out with my girlfriends and I partied up a storm. I was like, I'm not pregnant. And then I didn't get my period. And the day after my period was due, I got a super faint positive, and then the HCG was 56. So I don't know, all the tests have different sensitivities, but with my first son, he had a later implantation than my last two children, the one I'm pregnant with now and then my middle child.
Yeah.
So I find it all
so
fascinating.
Did you know when you ovulated? Maybe you ovulated a little bit later than you thought?
When I conceived my first child, I wasn't as psycho and I didn't know much about ovulation. So I didn't take ovulation predictor tests or know anything about cervical mucus. It was just like, okay, well, we're taking off the goalie. We want to have a baby. Let's see what happens. It should probably take quite a few months. And I mean, if I have to look back and try to remember, I always had a regular 28-day cycle, still do when I get my period. I'm super regular. But I think we only had unprotected sex like on day 8 or even maybe day 7. But then because we were only just started trying, my husband was still really nervous. He's like, no, but we're not actively trying. So we're not going to try again. But that one time
was enough.
Yeah, it was enough. Yeah, exactly. So it's just all of this is so fascinating to me. I wanted to chat before we close off for today about there's two things. Maybe you can tell me we have to pick one if you're short on time. But the one was polycystic ovaries, and the other one was miscarriages.
Mm.
Like, is there any information about why we have them? Is it something to do, or is it totally the genetic monopoly? Like, we don't really know.
So in terms of miscarriages, there is a, of course, chromosomes abnormality would be the biggest one.
And you can't test for that. You won't know.
No, you can't. But but there are many things one can do to promote the quality of their eggs.
Yes.
And the other thing that comes to my mind about miscarriages is progesterone levels. And we touched about that, because if the progesterone is unstable or we don't have enough progesterone, that can cause miscarriage, because progesterone, essentially, we have really high levels of progesterone, and that's what it's supposed to have. And that's what usually, if it's unstable or not enough, that's what maintains pregnancy. Progesterone is the hormone that maintains the pregnancy.
Yes.
And another thing that happens, so the corpus luteum continues to produce progesterone until placenta is being formed by the end of the first term. Until then, the corpus luteum in the ovaries makes a lot of progesterone to maintain that pregnancy, to allow the placenta to be formed. So, and many times what the miscarriages that happen might be when there is like a change of shifts between the corpus luteum and the placenta. So once the placenta is formed and starts to produce everything to maintain the pregnancy, the corpus luteum will disintegrate and stop making the progesterone. And then the placenta takes over with her progesterone and the rest of the hormones that it needs to produce to make in order to maintain that pregnancy. Many times we see that there are miscarriages around that time, the first trimester.
What week is that?
Around 12, up to 12.
Okay, so all the way up to 12. Okay.
Yeah.
And no, I had a bit of a theory. So I had a pregnancy loss in September last year. We conceived that was a really big surprise because that month we weren't actually trying, but I was still doing the ovulation test just to start getting like a understanding of my cycle and what's happening again because we just started. And I ended up ovulating super early, like 3 or 4 days early, so that it was really close to the last intercourse. And I was like, oh my gosh, okay, there's actually like a potential chance here, but actually still quite maybe not. And I ended up getting pregnant, but I lost the pregnancy at like, well, I only actually had the signs of a miscarriage at around 8 weeks, but this ultrasound showed that the baby didn't grow past like 5.5 weeks. Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry to hear that. Oh, thank you. I mean, yeah, it was really hard at the time.
Yeah.
But I have a theory that for whatever reason, the stressors in my body, we had a lot going on that month. I think my body forced this egg out early and that it wasn't actually a quality mature egg and that it got fertilized. And then it wasn't – that was my own little pseudoscientific theory of my own. It felt that way in my body. Is that even a possibility or am I just crazy?
Of course. No, you're not crazy at all. Stressors are huge stress has a huge impact on our egg quality. And if we are ovulating too soon in the cycle, when the follicle stimulating hormone or FSH doesn't have enough time to make what it needs to make, and also stress, one of the two things stress can make, really long cycles until even losing ovulation, or really, really short cycles. That also there are evidence that it can make that. So if the follicle stimulating hormone hasn't had enough time to mature enough the egg, and that actually that can also bring us somehow to a chromosome abnormality, because if it's not matured enough, then that can result in a miscarriage. So definitely it can happen. Yeah.
That's what it felt like to me. But luckily it didn't happen the next time. We have a healthy, almost 30-week-old in utero. Yes.
And I then hope it will continue to be a long, long, boring pregnancy.
Oh, let's see. I mean, it's getting to the hard part. But do you have time to discuss a little bit about the science of polycystic?
I do have a little bit of time, not too much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Give us a nutshell.
I have like 10, Okay, cool. PCOS, in a nutshell, is a hormonal disorder, but it's not really a hormonal disorder. It's more a metabolic disorder. When the ovaries doesn't manage the follicles don't manage to mature the eggs. So we'll have many, many follicles on the ovaries that haven't matured enough to be released and to result in the ovulation. There are four reasons why one might have PCOS. And that's something that today it's not as known that there are reasons. If one goes to the gynae and the gynae see that there are lots of follicles on, and when I say lots of follicles, meaning more than 12 or 15 follicles, unmatured follicles on the ovary, they will immediately say, you have PCOS. Now, it's also important to understand that you cannot be diagnosed with PCOS just based on how your ovary looks.
Okay.
So you need to have blood tests to confirm a PCOS. So there are four reasons why we might have PCOS. The most common reason for PCOS would be insulin resistance. That's the most common. And when you do the blood test for PCOS, also add the insulin piece of it. The second one, funny enough, is coming off the pill, because our ovaries and the brain start to learn to communicate again, and that can take a while. And in this time, the brain sends too much FSH or too little, or, you know, until everything settled and balanced again, your ovary might look like has lots of follicles, whereas it just starts to communicate again. That's the reason many teenagers get a diagnosis of PCOS, even though they don't have it, because the brain starts to communicate with the ovaries.
Okay.
The third reason would be inflammation. And that can be due to many things. And when I say inflammation, like a systematic inflammation on our body, it can be due to xenoestrogens from our environment. It can be because of nutrition that is not good for us, too much processed food, and etc. And the last one is a deeper reason. It might be to unbalanced thyroid, or some issues with iodine, or other things like that. So there are four reasons, and we need the best way to know what is the reason first to check if it's not insulin resistance, and by elimination. So if you didn't come off the pill recently, so it's not that. If you have checked your thyroid, so and everything's fine, and when I'm saying check your thyroid, it's not just the TSH, it's like the full panel of thyroid, the T3, T4, antibodies, you know, etc. And so it's not that. So by elimination is the best way. And maybe it's not actually PCOS, maybe it can be something else, like that causes other symptoms. The symptoms of PCOS would be acne on the face, might be hair on the face and losing hair on your head, weight gain around your tummy area, really long cycles that might not even have ovulation, but really, really long cycles. Those would be the signs of PCOS.
Okay.
Irregular bleedings and things like that.
Okay. So it sounds very complicated, and you have to get quite a lot of tests done. It's not straight and narrow simple. I hope that was helpful for anyone listening today. I certainly learned a lot more there and from our whole conversation. To close off, can you tell our listeners where they can find you online? I'll put all of the information in the show notes as well.
Thank you. So my Instagram is rona.fertilityaware. My website is fertilityaware.co.za. And you can email me, you can WhatsApp me. I'm very available. I make myself very available for everybody who wants to get this information.
Amazing. Yeah, it's really obvious in the way you speak about it that you have absolute passion for what you do. And I'm so grateful that you have the passion and that you're sharing it with us all. Thank you so much, Rona, for our chat today.
Thank you so much, Christine. Bye. Thank you, everybody. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Honest Hour podcast. I hope this recording inspired you to live in your honest truth. And I encourage you, if you enjoyed the episode, to subscribe and to rate the podcast. If you would like to connect with me online, I would love to hear from you. I'm on Instagram at The Honest Hour Podcast, and my website is christinamazarek.co.za. Thank you and have a beautiful day.